Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. All right, everybody, welcome back to One Broken Mom. I've been looking forward to this interview for several days. I've been talking it out with friends and letting them know that I was going to have my guest on today to talk about this particular topic. Mostly because I think a lot of people never really think about this as an idea and a thing that we're confronted with. And so today I have with me Britt Brogard, and she's a professor and the director of the Brogard Lab for Multisensory Research at the University of Miami. And her educational background includes a medical degree in neuroscience and a doctorate in philosophy. So I just like the immense smartness coming out here today. Her areas of research are actually in perception, synesthesia, blind sight, consciousness, neuropsychiatry, and emotions. She's written over 100 peer review articles. Her work has been featured in various public media, including Nightline, ABC News, The Huffington Post, Fox News, NBC. I can keep going on and on. She's the 100th president of the Southern Society for Philosophy and Psychology and was the first female president of the Central States Philosophical Association. So she's pretty much a badass. And I can say that because I love women and I love empowering women and helping them be happy and successful themselves. However, not all women are like that and feel like that. And in fact, at times, some of us even have these moments of jealousy or envy towards our peers' success that makes us feel uncomfortable, makes us ask ourselves, wow, why is this weird feeling bugging me? It's not really who I am. And then as we saw in the wake of the Me Too movement, visceral hatred directed towards Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony, as well as towards other women who shared their own stories, not just by men, but hatred from other women. And so we know the movies like Mean Girls, we know the gossip, we know the put downs and the insults, and then the even not so obvious ways women sabotage each other in the workplace, especially if it's in a male dominated company or industry. So it begs the question, if we know how hard it is sometimes to be a woman and live with our challenges that we have at us in socially and culturally, why on earth would we be hateful towards other women? And that's why Britt's on today, and it's to help us understand this idea of female misogyny. So welcome to the show, Britt.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so excited. So when we use the term misogyny, and this is what happened as I was talking with friends and colleagues about it, the word is commonly associated with men. And so when I told people that I was going to be doing this interview with you and that used the frame female misogyny, I got back these puzzled looks like, is that really a thing? So I want to start off first by defining the word misogyny and what it is.
Right. Literally, it means hatred of women. But it doesn't mean hatred of all women. It means hatred in the broad sense of hatred. When we talk about hatred in the broad sense, we talk about either hatred in a more narrow sense or contempt, where you're looking down on people. So we see that, for example, if you talk about hate speech or hate crime or hate group, it contains both like hate and contempt. So it's really hate or contempt for women, but again, not all women. So which women are not condemned, to use an old-fashioned term, or hated? Well, of course, that depends. But there are two ideals that, one is an ideal and the other is more of a myth. One ideal is sort of the ideal of femininity. That's not a new one. That was already back in the 50s and even the 40s in France and so on, there were books written on that ideal, but it still prevails today. And it's basically that women should be feminine, not masculine. That's to sum it up. Mm-hmm. That sounds like circular, but if you spell out then what is it you mean by feminine and masculine, you basically get the stereotype of today, right? So you know, men are considered strange or queer if they wear makeup, right? That's just an example. But that's maybe an extreme example. Another example would just be like staying home with your kid as a dad is unusual, mm-hmm. right? And even looked down upon, but not, I mean, it's almost expected if anyone is staying home, it would be the mother. Mm-hmm. So hatred or contempt for women could then be, so for the hatred, when women refuse to stay inside or get close to that ideal, right? So if you have I know you have some tattoos, and if you have tattoos, for example, you are already deviating from that ideal in many other ways too, but say this is one way you are deviating from that ideal. And so some people, men or women, or neither men nor women, or both men and women, whatever where you are on the gender spectrum, might hate you for that, which is because it's, for them, is unnatural for, say, a woman to have tattoos, or a woman to be the CEO of a company, or for a woman to be the president of the United States. And so the hatred often amounts to a kind of punishment, and so that's also a point made by my colleague, not colleague here, but a colleague in my area, Kate Mann, in her book, The Logic of Misogyny. But the other form, the other way that you can be sort of subjected to misogyny is if you have you're not doing anything extreme. You might even be fitting the feminine ideal. You might be looking feminine, being subservient to men, and so on. And yet women are culturally, historically associated with filth, dirt. And it's not filth or dirt in sort of course, the literal sense. It's like a metaphor, but it has to do with disgust, that is a kind of social disgust. And women are disgusting because they are more in touch. That's the myth, right? The myth is that they're more in touch with their bodies. They're very bodily. They're not very mindful, that means something else, but they're not sort of they're not intellectual, they're not intelligent, right? And they're filthy and disgusting. And of course, these are myths, and so they're ideologies. So they're not, it's not like men are sitting around always saying that, I'm sure some are, but, or that women are for that matter, but it's sort of ingrained in all of us.
Interesting. You know, and you made me think about is that last point there, because I've seen and witnessed, you know, men that, you know, that comes out kind of like in fetish ideas or like a sexualization, like that filth of treating women poorly sexually. Maybe they're okay in other areas, but at the end of the day, they just have that sense of, they want to punish them. And, you know, like you can be like, you know, really hot and you can be really smart, but at the end of the day, you're just a slut. You're just a dirty, same, you know, slut for, you know, whatever. And that, you know, that's a kind of like a, I mean, that's such a strange, like to me, it's like the dichotomy of why some things are okay and then some things aren't okay. You know, where do they think the origins of these beliefs and this contempt and hatred, you know, may stem from? And I know we're all unique. I mean, we both know that. So we all have different experiences and circumstances, but I got to believe there's some sort of common areas for people of how they end up evolving and developing these types of feelings.
I mean, it's a cult. It's partially, of course, cultural inheritance, right? So the norms that existed 200 years ago, say, in Europe or here in America or elsewhere, they don't just go away, right? They might become less sort of obvious, harder to spot, but they sometimes they change a little bit, but they change slowly, and so that's where they came from. And so then you can go back and say, well, where did that come from historically then? Well, good question. In terms of, it's not clear that you can actually appeal to evolution as an explanation, because there are many examples where of societies, if you go far enough back, where women actually were in charge, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not evolution. It's probably religion, but not one single religion, mm-hmm. but almost. I wouldn't say all religions, certainly not all religions, but many religions dictate this kind of hierarchy where men are up here high up and women are lower down in the hierarchy. So maybe religions, or even when people are not religious, that has influenced the culture many years ago, and that's carried on. We have these what people call implicit biases, and we have them towards women, have them, many women have them towards themselves as well. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, where it came from. So in terms of evolution, yeah, there were societies or communities where men were in charge, but there were also many examples where women were actually in charge, mm-hmm. where women were thought of as stronger. And actually, in some ways, women are stronger. If you just look at, like, women live longer than men, for example. I don't know if that has any relation to evolution, but maybe one day I'll find out.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and I've seen too, or, you know, understood from historical context too, where, you know, at some point in time, you know, women were created into more of a state of property. And in order to be able to be traded, you know, from family to family, married into and things like that. And so a lot of the rights are, you know, were eroded because there were benefits, you know, by commingling certain families together. And obviously the bloodline starts with a woman, you know, of giving birth and, you know, creating heirs and children. Is there any parts of where a misogyny might erupt from? You know, I read, and I'm asking this question because I read this book, you know, a while back by Alan Jenks, and it's called Why Men Hate Women. And he's actually out of the UK, and he has a center where he treats a lot of men that are abusive towards women. And he related a lot of experiences between men and their mothers, and having this developing some sort of deep, you know, a kind of a misunderstood or not quite, you know, conscious, hatred towards their mom for whatever reason. Either she was emotionally unavailable, she actually physically, you know, or emotionally abandoned them, and they feel this sense of hatred towards women. Now, I feel like that would be like towards all women, and you're saying that misogyny is around certain aspects of women and not just women in general. So is there a distinction between, well, I guess, sexism and misogyny?
Well, let me put it this way, that so you have these two main forms of misogyny. Mm-hmm. One is hate-based. So hate is like a sort of an escalated form of anger. That's an easy, simple way to think about it. Mm-hmm. Contempt is like looking down on the person. I think the contempt-based form is much more widespread in society. So I think that's closer to being for all women, right? Does that mean that a boy has contempt for his mother or when he grows up? No, probably not, right? So that's why it's not all women. And the mother, presumably, in many cases, where boys have a very close relationship to their mother, the mother has at least some of those traditional traits. I mean, that's a generalization. We can't generalize like that, but I bet that if you look closer, that's probably what you would find, because if if she has those feminine traits, or many of them anyway, she's not like, she's not what, well, she shouldn't be punished, she should be praised according to the man, right? So so it might also be that men, of course, idealize their mothers, so maybe they see them as having those traits, and so perhaps they're less likely to have the hate based form of misogyny towards mothers or also sometimes sisters and other family members, but the contempt is still there, right? So it's just hidden from consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. The contempt towards women, even the boys that who adore their mothers, mm-hmm. they can still have this contempt towards women, even her, because she's a woman, except they might not be thinking about it, but they're really feeling disgusted by all this bodily stuff, like women give birth, women menstruate, women, so it's that is this like disgust, well it's the contempt based form sort of derives from disgust, which then became social disgust of forms.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now you had identified, I had read an article, and I'll have a link in the show notes for other people to be able to follow up and read this as well, four basic types of female misogynists, and you called them the Puritan, the self-critic, the self-loather, and the she-devil. And so I want to go through and actually talk about each of these different types, and so that we can actually understand them better, because it is fascinating. Again, when we talk about misogyny, it's usually men hating women. And, you know, and the topic here today is about the fact that, you know, women actually do perpetrate it against, you know, one another as well. So first, let's start with the Puritan. You know, who is she and what type of female misogynist is this?
Yeah, so in this case, so now we're talking about, as you emphasize, about women who hate women, but for many of the same reasons that men do. So we can also look at female misogynists as either haters or contemners.
Contemptors. That works. I know what you mean.
Yeah, right. The Puritan is one of those women who actually buys into the feminist ideal, or not the feminist ideal, the femininity, ideal of femininity. And she basically thinks, whether consciously or not, that women should be domestic, you know, subservient to men, kind, mild-mannered, alluring, sexually pure, at least before marriage, and so on. She probably has gotten or adopted this ideal from her family, maybe her husband, maybe friends, maybe culture. And she actually considers herself satisfying those, many of those traits, or having many of those traits, right? Or at least being close enough that she is not one of the bad women. Mm-hmm. So she is basically a good woman because she has these good women, female traits. Mm-hmm. So maybe she's not young, but then she's youthful, alluring, mild-tempered, kind, maybe, and so on. Mm. So she is the kind of person who might be tended to punish people or let out of people if people deviate from that ideal. So you deviate at least in some ways from that ideal. I deviate from that ideal too. and then you occasionally will have people let out of you, women, in fact. Whether you have women letting out at you probably depends on, well, are you like an online personality? So I often have women like saying bad things in the comment section on my Psychology Today posts. And well, who knows? Maybe they're men and they're just writing under a female name, right? But
right.
You might also just have, if you're a mom, like I'm a mom, you might find the other school moms are those kinds of Puritans who really think that you are weird or mm-hmm. you deviate from the way you ought to be. Right? So my daughter attends a very traditional private school in Miami, and there are school moms who really think that if they could, they should probably punish me for my deviation. For example, I'm a single mother. That's already one big no-no.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's like, I think it just makes me think of like standing on the sidelines of the soccer games, you know, and the clusters of, and I remember when my kids were little, like I just wasn't that mom. I'd show up in a leather jacket, tattoos, you know, and I was just like, man, I do not fit in here. Like, this is not my people. You know, fortunately the women were nice, but there is that tendency of like, you know, a kind of prejudging and grouping everybody first. You know, and whether or not they fit into there. And so it sounds like with this one here, and I think you did say this earlier that, you know, this is likely something learned. And the word Puritan obviously makes us think of Nathaniel Hawthorne and the Scarlet Letter. And it thinks of like deeply religious, you know, underpinnings yeah. to where somebody yeah. picks these things up, because a lot of this seems to be really, you know, written in some of the religious texts, like the Bible, about subservient, you know, attitudes and things like that. Now, is this type of a woman, again, you know, does she have a job? I mean, does she work and also, you know, integrated into society? I mean, a stay-at-home mom isn't natural, you know, just automatically a Puritan, right? Or no?
Yeah. Okay. Well, not all stay-at-home moms, of course, are not automatically Puritans. Mm-hmm. But, and also, you don't have to have all of the traits to consider yourself being close enough to that ideal. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it probably isn't a single woman who would have that whole long list of traits that are sort of considered classically feminine. Mm-hmm. So it's something about like how many ways do you actually stray from that ideal, right? Mm-hmm. And if it crosses some kind of boundary, and some ways of straying from that ideal, of course, are worse than others. So back to your question, the working mom, of course, she's not staying at home with the children, assuming she even has children, right? So she's missing a couple of those check items on the list of the ideals of femininity, but she probably has a lot of the other ones, or at least she thinks she does, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not really about whether or not she does. It's about whether she thinks she does.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, and as I, you know, as my brain is like running through here, when we get through these, cause I want to talk about us feeling some of these things and then the action. Cause I think that's where the, you know, for me, it's it affects us most deeply is, you know, some people listening to the show might hear some of these things that they've got, you know, planted in a script somewhere. The difference is between feeling them because they were there, they were a message or a story that was passed down to you culturally or through your family, and then taking action on whether or not you turn around and take it out against other women for it. And I think that's kind of like the two things, the distinctions I want to make. Now the next one you have is the self-critic. And so let's how is she different from the others?
She's very similar, except that she includes herself in the bad group. So she considers herself a bad woman, whether again not necessarily consciously, but she thinks that is an ideal, that femininity is an ideal, and that you should get as close to it as feasible. And she has not. She's not there. Mm-hmm. She's not in that. She's not close enough. So she is very critical of herself, right? So she thinks she's too fat or too big or too brown or too black or too single or mm-hmm. Too poor, whatever it can be, right? That is not considered like something that a good woman, a trait that a good woman would have. Of course, different people might think like different, that women should have different traits, like even if they all sort of think of femininity, but there's some overlap, I'm thinking, in terms of those traits. And she doesn't think. She might even be very feminine, but she doesn't think that she is, and she thinks she should be.
Interesting. So is she more or less hostile to herself than to other people?
So that's what I'm thinking, the way that when I have looked at the different kinds of misogyny, I'm thinking that she's more preoccupied with herself, but in a critical way rather than in a narcissistic way. Although, of course, it can also like go overboard and become almost like a form of narcissism. But but usually it's more like she's a, you know, her own worst critic. But it's not about, it's not because, say, oh, I should have gotten an education. That's not the reason. In this case, it's because she doesn't have those feminine traits. Or maybe she does, but she doesn't think that she does.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, coming into this, you know, we, again, thinking about holding a misogynistic belief and acting on it are different things. And we're talking about a woman here that still has those elements of believing that there's ideals and things that women are not successfully, you know, aligning with. And in this case here with the self-critic, you know, she's not really out there on a pulpit, maybe the way the Puritan is. You know, standing out there commenting on everybody and why you're not good enough and, you know, how dare you, whatever. This is a pretty quiet, you know, misogynist, you know, having those feelings, but a lot of them being directed at herself as well, which seems kind of sad. You know, how would we know somebody? I guess, you know, to me, I was going to say, how would we know? And I guess I think is I would see that this is the woman who's, you know, posting a lot of using social media. That's how we can identify people, or making self-deprecating comments on a regular basis, you know, about themselves.
Well, yeah. And she might also make very generalized comments about how women should be. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but she's probably so preoccupied with herself that she's probably less likely to really take it out on specific women, but you might make general comments about women.
Yeah, interesting. Well, so then now we're coming down into something that sounds similar. So I'm interested in hearing the distinction for you, which is the self-loather.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was actually hard to find some terms that would distinguish that, but we were really now over in a different category of misogyny. So we are over in the category that involves contempt. And contempt, as I see it, is a kind of social disgust. So it's disgust that's similar to normal disgust. But it's also a way of looking down on people or having disrespect for them, right? So you're looking down. In contempt, you're looking down. Mm-hmm. If you're looking down on women, it must be for some reason. If you're disgusted with them, it must be for some reason. Well, it's because they have this filthiness to them. They have something that can provoke disgust. They have something that makes them inferior to maybe to some exceptional cases of women, and certainly to men. So there are lots of historical cases even where you see women described as manipulative or irrational or incompetent or dishonest or promiscuous or anything like something that has more to do with the body. So I actually had an interesting example to illustrate this. This might help a little bit. It's from the philosopher, political philosopher, Martha Nussbaum. She cites Jonathan Swift's poem, and it's not a real poem, so it's not going to be difficult to understand. I mean, it's not a real poem in the sense like
right, yeah, no, I get it. It's like my high school English is coming back to me. Like, I understand, we're sitting there going, I don't get it.
Yeah. Right, it's called The Lady's Dressing Room. Okay, so in the poem, a man sneaks into, he has a lover, he sneaks into her private quarters, her room, after she's done, like, beautifying herself. She spent like 5 hours washing and dressing. And now he walks into her bathroom and or like room, apartment, whatever it is. And it goes like this. Snot, earwax, dandruff, hairs plucked from her chin, clothes with sweaty armpits, skin oil, a pool of scrapings of her teeth and gums, stockings that smell like stinking toes, all of which turned poor Strephon, that's his name, about. The climax of his revulsion arrives when he opens the laundry chest and he finds a Pandora's box of evils. He finds evidence of urine and feces and menstrual fluid, things which must not be expressed. And so he like gets really disgusted and he says, oh, Celia, shits. That's how it ends. So, is it like, this is from, it's clearly not a contemporary one, but
right.
It's kind of where you can see where the disgust of filth comes from. So it's not, Martha Nussbaum actually argues that it is these bodily stuff that women are associated with. I think it's like a little more metaphorical. So mm-hmm. I think that it's true that the filth, that's sort of what provokes contempt. So this is the other form of misogyny that we're talking about, the self-loathing. And in this case, is that you include the woman who is has this contempt for other women also has contempt for herself.
Mm-hmm.
But the filth is not necessarily, I don't think it's necessarily like, it doesn't have to be discussed with menstrual fluids, for example, mm-hmm. or earwax. It's rather other things like promiscuity.
Mm-hmm.
She has too much sex, or she's too manipulative. She's deceptive. She's dishonest. She's mm-hmm. too angry. Mm-hmm. She's irrational, incompetent, mm-hmm. unintelligent. But in this case, like in the other case of the self-critical, the self-hater, in the other case, in this case, the woman also actually think that she herself is disgusting in some mm-hmm. sense, disgusting or filthy or like deserving of disrespect.
Right.
And I mentioned like that the famous TV show, the Handmaid's Tale, as an example of it, where you see, for example, you see like one of the commanders, I mean, the wives, right, is an example. Like, I don't know if your listeners mm-hmm. have watched the show, but this is like where women are used, they're sort of enslaved to produce children because there's a problem with infertility, and there are several examples of that. But there's also Lydia is a one who's supposed to train these women, who are supposed to become these breeders of children. And if you look closer at her background, it turns out that before they got into this society that the TV show depicts, she was sort of a pro-life extremist. And so she's like thinking of herself as trying to be saving women from sin, but she's also at the same time a self-loather. She does not think highly of herself. She mm-hmm. thinks that she belongs further down in the hierarchy, well, higher up perhaps than the women, right? That she's also loathing, but certainly lower down than the men, right? She thinks that she deserves to be down there in the dirt mm-hmm. where she belongs with the other filthy women.
Yeah. It seems like between the self-critic and the self-loather, there's this, the turning point is a self-critic may actually feel that they can redeem themselves. Like there's a goal that they can attain, that there's an ideal that they can reach. But when you get into this realm of where the self-loather is, where it's like there is no upward mobility, there is no improvement. You're stuck yeah. where you are. There is no getting better. And that's like, I mean, that just, it feels terrible to, you know, to have a mindset like that of, you know, you know, that, you know, one has hope, you know, as little as it is by being a self-critic. But the, with the loather, it's just like, no, there's no way out of this. Like, it just feels like it's such an, a much more emotionally dark place for, you know, a woman to be. And, you know, and as you were describing it, it's like, it's as if women have been dehumanized in this mindset, you know, that everything that is natural, truly natural, is a point of, you know, of contempt, right? Like it shouldn't be there, which is just obviously strange because we are all human, men and women. Yeah. We both do the same things, but yeah, I feel like to me, that's the difference, but like the emotional difference between that self-critic and that self-lover. One is working to do better. And one is like, there's no point. I'm disgusting. Everyone's disgusting. Like,
yeah, that's exactly right. And you hit the nail on the head, because the contempt, when people have the contempt, whether it's a man or a woman who has contempt for women, it's usually maybe they don't think much about where it comes from, but if you look at where it comes from, it usually comes from the idea that there is sort of a certain essence that is female. Like as a female essence, right? An essence in the sense that we could think of like humans. What would the essence be of humans if we're like not misogynistic? Well, maybe like they have human DNA, maybe some other things too. But the essence of women is just infiltrated with this dirt and filth, these like really bad traits, immoral traits, and that's what leads to the contempt, and that's why if it's something that's genetic, and that's like there's a lot of people throughout history who argue that it was genetic, right? And women genetically are like that. Yeah, then you can't really change it, right? If it's hardwired, whereas like the feminine ideal, when you deviate from that and you're hated because of that and you need to get punished because of that, then that is in some sense because it's your fault, right? You could have like chosen to stay at home, or you could have chosen to grow out your hair, or you could have chosen to not get tattoos or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So that is like a difference there. Another difference in addition to what I mentioned.
Yeah. So now we're finally at the she devil. And I think that's, you know, I mean, that term in itself, I think everybody's like, yeah, I kind of know what that is. But what is a she devil when it comes into the realm of, again, female misogyny?
Yeah. So I'm thinking like it's like the self-loather, except she's like the opposite. She has no loathing. I mean, she doesn't loathe herself. She does not have contempt for herself. She has contempt for other women. She takes herself to be superior to other women, maybe also to other men, but at least to other women, right? So she's like this unique being who's up there with all the men, the top men. And then women are down, below her. So she's looking down on them, right, from her high chair, her moral high chair. And she will typically, I mean, one way that I have described this person could be in terms of being extremely career minded, but at the same time trying to push down other women, I mean, to get them up of the ladder, so they're not in competition, but that's just one example. It can be it could be other ways that you could take yourself to be up there with the men, right? Maybe it's in some sport that you're doing, or there are other ways that you can look down on women, but not yourself, because you uniquely, or maybe with a few others, have these perfectly great traits. Yeah, like you are not, for example, you are not irrational. Other women are irrational. You're not incompetent and unintelligent, but other women are. You are not manipulative, but other women are. and so on. Your pure mind, perhaps, but other women are disgusting, filthy bodies. There are different ways it can manifest itself.
Right. And it sounds like, too, that it's possible that while some of these are based on this feminine ideal, and going back to the Puritan of, you know, what women are supposed to do, subservient, you know, sexually pure, whatever it is, this particular type of misogynist may fully embrace a masculine, you know, identity, or what we would call a masculine identity, maybe because of rejecting female identity, if right. It's all tied into that. But also this woman could also be what she believes is the purest female identity and rejects all women because they're incapable of reaching it. So it's almost like, you know, the she-devil can be, you know, kind of a two sides of the same coin here.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, and I say the she-devil because I feel like that's the one because the outwardness of this is that this seems like the one between the Puritan and this one is the one that maybe exhibits the most hostility towards other women, like actual taking action. And that's why I wanted to talk about, like, you know, it's one thing to internalize this, but it's another thing to behave outwardly and act with aggression towards other people. And, you know, she-devils seem like they're the type.
They tend to have dark personality traits. Mm-hmm. The dark traits are narcissism, antisocial personality disorder, which would be psychopathy in normal terms, similar enough anyway. And
it's normal for one broken mom. So that's
borderline personality disorder. But those are not to be thought of as necessarily clinical conditions, right? Because they exist as clinical conditions. You can have borderline personality disorder and really have a clinical condition, but you can also have some of those traits that are just like more extreme in the normal population, but they don't reach the level of being a clinical illness or a psychiatric illness. And it seems that those traits are often associated with the she-devil. So she's like more likely to have narcissistic traits. She's more likely to have traits that are similar to those of a psychopath. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean necessarily a serial killer psychopath, yep. But a psychopath in the sense where you can have the CEO of your company might be a psychopath, because that's like apparently a good trait to have if you want to become the CEO of a company. Or the dean, or the dean of a college, or something. To use my own world as an example, or maybe a little higher up. Let's say provost.
Right. Yeah.
I was not talking about anyone here.
I was going to say, do we need to make sure that Brit does not mean anyone in particular?
No, they are completely exceptional at this university, so they would never, ever, ever have dark traits.
Right, right. No, but one. I get that. Yeah. Now, I feel like sometimes with the she-devil, you know, some women may be mistakenly accused of being a she-devil just because of the narcissistic part of it. You know, the woman who, you know, posts a lot of selfies, for example, you know, those women do get attacked a lot, right? You know, even if they look like they are some sort of perfect feminine, you know, there seems to be right now, we love to attack people for posting a selfie and that accusing everybody of being narcissistic. I don't personally believe that that's a fair diagnosis and assessment of everybody who's doing it or driven to do that.
Yeah.
But I've seen women, you know, I've seen very kind women that happen to be very attractive and men like them. And then they just get like attacked by other women and accused of being something that they're really not. Is that jealousy or is that another form of female misogyny? Because I feel like some women who do that probably wouldn't consider themselves misogynist. Like in general, I don't think women would consider themselves misogynistic.
Yeah, it can be jealousy if it's related to a loss. Jealousy is more related to like, I'm about to lose something. It doesn't have to be jealousy in a romantic sense, right? It could mm-hmm. be losing something else. It could be losing your spots at work or your promotion at work, or so that would still count as jealousy. We can also talk about envy, and often we just say jealous and envy is used them synonymously, but envy is more focused on that you really want what the other person has, right? So it's not that you're afraid of losing something that you already have, but rather something you don't have and you wish you had. And if a woman is very beautiful and attractive to men and so on, that would be a kind of envy, presumably, in terms of that would then spark that hatred. I do argue in elsewhere, not in the article that you mentioned, but elsewhere, I've argued that that envy is a way, is like a platform for or springboard for sort of for hatred. So it's envy need not develop into hatred, and theoretically speaking, maybe you could be envious in a positive sense, where you're just like, where it just makes you work harder to mm-hmm. say become, you know, finish your degree or whatever. Mm-hmm. But envy has a tendency to escalate into spiteful envy, and that's really envy that then has provoked hatred. And so envy, so we are envious of women more commonly than men, because we are capable or more capable of comparing ourselves to other women than we are to other men. And when you're able to see yourself in the other person's shoes, in some sense, that's more likely to make you envious. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you might be envious of if you're working, let's say you're a secretary in a big company and the CEO is driving a Ferrari or some other sports car, and you might be a little bit envious, but it's usually not going to be developing into some kind of strong envy. Whereas if it's like someone who is like you, right, and they get something, or it's not like they just get it, right? Maybe they earned it, but you mm-hmm. might feel envious, and or they might have it if you're talking about the looks of a person, or the intelligence of a person. You might so women can compare themselves to other women. It's much easier for women to do that than it is to compare themselves to a man. So mm-hmm. so it's strange that that's what we need to focus on, but that again is probably cultural heritage as well.
Right. And so envy is different than misogyny. And I think, because I want to talk about whether or not that is, you know, if there is a distinction between the two, for anybody that's sitting there wondering, like, am I being misogynistic towards other women when I do see that and I have that sense, like, you know, when we see a woman that has something that we want, it could be professionally, it could be aesthetically, it could be for a million things. So, you know, she's got a boyfriend, she has a great car, she's got a great job, you know, she's being successful here, I'm not. That's not the same as being misogynistic, right? That's a totally...
No, it can be, because like you could ask yourself, if you feel like envy, it's very natural. Ask yourself, well, do I dislike the person for this? And now we're assuming like the person hasn't done anything against you. Well, it's not the reason. Yeah. Is it because she's beautiful that do you dislike her? Or is it just that you wish you were also beautiful? Mm-hmm. Or someone who's like a trainer, personal trainer, and you're like, wish you also had muscles like that or a toned body like that. Mm-hmm. So is it like you wish you were like that, or is it no, you really dislike her, right? I would prefer to say hate, right? But not consent in that case, but envy doesn't lead to consent, it leads to hate in the other sense, the escalated form of dislike, the escalated form of anger. Are you feeling like you hate her? Are you feeling like, just as dislike, because people are not usually they don't want to admit that they hate people, right? So so you can ask dislike, do you dislike the person because she's beautiful? Do you dislike her, the personal female personal trainer, because she has a toned body? Do people dislike you because you're successful, have a really successful podcast, right? Mm-hmm. You can envy without disliking, and that's when it's less, then it's certainly not misogyny, right? But mm-hmm. if it gets to dislike, if you can say dislike, you probably hate, and that's misogyny.
Mm, interesting.
That means that envy has sparked misogyny.
Yes, and moved into that place. And I guess I think of it as more like an action, you know, either a hostility towards yourself or, you know, expressing hostility towards other people versus just having some normal feelings, you know, that we're
all going to have.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, I am talking mostly about the emotion, but often, I mean, the truth is, like, we are not very good at hiding our emotions, even if we like to think that we are. So they tend to come out even when we don't know it, that we're acting or behaving in a way that shows our emotions. So we are, in some sense, wearing our emotions on our sleeves. I don't think that you can separate it from behavior. If you could really keep your feelings to yourself, well, maybe they are, that's not misogyny then, because then it's not so strong that you need to act out. Mm-hmm. If nobody notices, right?
Right.
So then you might just be thinking, oh, wait, am I misogynistic now because I envy this person? Or I envy you because your podcast is so great. But I don't dislike you, right?
Nice.
Right. So that's not misogyny. And it's not necessary. I mean, I don't see that as being harmful. Mm-hmm. It may not motivate me to start my own podcast, but it could, but it might not. So it might be either neutral or it might even be positive. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've experienced that with other women, especially when, you know, some of us run in similar circles and we check ourselves of like, gosh, you know, especially when, again, social media does that. Like, social media really can grow a lot of these feelings in people because you see the posts and you see somebody and you're just like, you know, the envy can be normal. And that's why I wanted to touch on it, because it can be normal, but there is a fine line between it feeling like it's, you know, diabolical and versus just, you know, and like you said there, it's like feeling envy, but at the same time, I like where your mark is like, does it cross over into dislike? Do I still admire this person? Do I still respect this person? Am I feeling like, wow, they got something I'd like, but I don't, my feelings about them hasn't changed. Like that's when you're like, you're fine. You're normal. You're just a human being like the rest of us, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because envy, like, is almost close to, can be almost close to admiration, right? Mm-hmm. It adds a little element like that you also wish you had it, because you can admire someone without wishing you had that.
Right.
Right.
Like, right.
You can
totally
admire like an old male philosopher like Aristotle without wishing that you had been an old male philosopher or something.
Right. Now, how widespread is female misogyny? You know,
I think it's very widespread. I mean, there are some studies of it on the internet where it suggests that it's really prevalent on the internet, but there are not so many studies of it. So we don't really know. So this is just from interviewing people and talking to people about women, about misogyny and what their experiences, that I get the sense that it's very prevalent. But there are some studies. It's just easier to study misogyny online, of course. Mm-hmm. And there are studies showing that women are even more misogynistic than men in their online behavior. So
interesting.
But yeah, so I mean, that's one study. And of course, it's like it was limited to Twitter. So we would still have to look at a lot of other studies. I'm sure there will be more studies coming out. Maybe there are even some that are like published first online that I haven't seen yet, and so on. But yeah, it's definitely becoming a more common sort of phenomenon to investigate, like female misogyny, because you're right. Like, historically, misogyny was almost thought as a man hating women, but the man part is really not part even of the original meaning of the word. It just means women hatred.
It seems like in the last couple of years, and maybe it's just because of age and maturity and paying attention to different things, you know, that could happen there. But, you know, I feel like you can see a lot more cases of female misogyny, you know, due to our sociopolitical climate, you know, and being more outspoken and having a platform, again, through social media to express that, you know, before, before there was Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever, you know, it was hard to broadcast your ideals and your beliefs about women, you know, men and women
That's
alike,
exactly
but, but now you can. And then that there's this, also this rising, you know, of course, of this antithesis to this. And there's a lot more acrimony, it feels like, out there about these two, you know, these two things coming to kind of coming to head. And I, you know, and I guess, you know, as a philosopher yourself, you know, it starts to beg this question of, you know, I look at it as this is a mental health condition that needs to be treated. But, you know, these are belief systems, right? I mean, there's parts of it that are actually belief systems. Some of it's not grounded in anything biological or neuroscience or anything like that. But, you know, at what point do you, you know, try to treat somebody who shows misogynistic behavior? Is, you know, is it addressable? Is it treatable? You know, how do you tackle that? Does that make sense?
Well, that's a good question. But yes, I agree. I think that even though it's not biological, is more like a cultural or inherited, culturally inherited thing. I think that just as like implicit biases, we there's been some talk about that. For example, how Black people even have implicit biases against Black people, right? So, so naturally, it's not, it's obvious that women would have implicit biases against women, even though they're women. But can you treat those? Well, you can train people if they're willing to be trained to have, you can't tell them don't have an implicit bias because implicit means unconscious. So how can you like, but you can train them. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of ways that have been investigated that, that work, and it just depends on the area. So one way, so there's something about in-group, out-group. So so by having friends, that are not necessarily all like you. So the Puritan perhaps should get to know you or me, right? And become friends with them. this is the like befriending the out-group member is known in other areas of implicit bias. So having a lot of people, friends from different cultures, or going to say, a fitness studio where there are lots of people from different cultures. In Miami, there are lots and lots of people from different cultures. And I do think that that makes a difference. And I also lived in St. Louis, and I can say, well, one thing that, that there are not that many, relatively speaking, Black people in Miami, when there are lots of Black people in St. Louis where I worked before. And it seems that, but on the other hand, lots of Latinos, or Latinx, as some say, lots of people from Europe, Spain, other Europeans, even other Danish people, even like there's another Danish person here at the university. And I think that, that it's basically something that you can, to go back to your question and not take it in, off the track. It's basically you can train yourself to, but not probably you can't really train yourself, but you can train other people, and that's just one way, like by befriending people who are unlike you, and other. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of other ways, and we know that anonymizing like CVs or if people are doing some kind of musical test performance, if you don't know whether the violinist is a woman or a man, then they're more likely to end up in the orchestra. And so there are a bunch of ways that we can sort of bypass these implicit biases. But I guess it will be hard to get people willing to be treated.
Right. Yeah. It's like, and like you said, as long as people still cluster in communities of interest, right? And so they find each other, it is hard. But, you know, like you said, if somebody is willing to be open-minded, I think that's usually the difference that you see is that, you know, I think you and I both have met men and women alike that have had those biases, you know, through their life, have ventured out into the world, and then found that one person that changed their mind. you know, just because they got to know them on a whole different level, they got to have that connection with them. And then they began to question, you know, some of those things that they have inside of their head about certain things, and have been able to, you know, to alter, you know, their viewpoints and stuff like that. So, but there's a willingness, obviously, just like with anything that we talk about on the show and just in general, it starts with us to have, to be willing to be open-minded to that. And what I like about this conversation is for anybody that's sitting there thinking about themselves, and if they're holding on to some of these biases that actually, you know, are misogynistic in nature, you know, and you're willing to step into, well, maybe I should think about how I change these, like you suggested. You know, think about the people that you've avoided because you've had these, you know, feelings kind of crop up in there, and reach out and grab coffee or go hang out with them like you've not wanted to do, and just see if, you know, learning and understanding a little bit more about another person doesn't help. Because I feel, you know, at the end of the day with misogyny, there's this own sense of self-shame, you know, behind it. Like it's easier, I think, for some people to hate somebody else than it is to address some of their own internal pain and suffering, you know, that's in there. It's easier to control everybody, or, you know, it's easier, air quotes, to try to control other people, to try to get them to fit your norms and your own standards, than it is sometimes to really sit down with yourself and kind of work on your inner world. And so anybody that can see themselves in this, you know, that's a big first step, in my opinion, to being able to say, like, you know, let's talk about what's where your conflict really is inside of here. Cause it isn't really that these people out here are doing something against you. You know, you're just, you're projecting all of that out there, you know?
Yeah.
So, cool. Well, this has been great. And so I want to give you a chance, you know, is there anything that, you know, you've got that people can reach out to you? I know you've written several books, that, you know, on a variety of different topics in mental health and mental wealth. And so I want to turn this over to you to be able to talk about, you know, what you're working on and how, and I'll have links to you, but, you know, what should people be, if you want people to reach out to you, what should they be looking for?
Well, my Psychology Today blogs, I have the one called Mysteries of Love. I have another one that's, I try to put the slightly more scientific stuff over there, but not always. It's called The Superhuman Mind. But the Mysteries of Love is usually where I discuss the misogyny and other things related to that, also envy, jealousy, and so on. And so it's just my name, Psychology Today, those blocks will come up, or The Mysteries of Love, Psychology Today will also work. I'm working on a book on hatred, actually, called Hatred, Our Most Dangerous Emotion. And that's, I finished the manuscript, so I'm just waiting for the copy that was edited already, so by the editor, and waiting for the copy edited version. So it should be out in a few months. It's appealing to a general audience, even though it's published with an academic press. I had a book on romantic love as well with Oxford University Press, but that is also, again, appealing to an even more general audience, not an academic audience at all. With the hatred book, I tried to write it in a way where it would be readable by everyone. But I do have, I did have to take on some difficult topics because you get into politics and all kinds of things like that when you talk about hatred. So,
Well, and I'll have links to the books that you already have published. Those will be in the podcast notes for people to be able to get to. And I'm fascinated by the topic of hatred, you know, not for weird reasons, except that it's not well discussed. It's not well understood. It's an emotion, as you know, people retreat from. More or less because of a lot of fear behind it and experiences that we've had when we've ran into hatred or what we deem as hatred. And so when you get that book out, I would love to be able to talk with you more about that because I think that may be, it's easy for us to show joy in our happiness, but it really becomes difficult for us when we need to let a very natural emotion, like, I really hate this. I'm really angry. I'm upset about this. And that's the one that we're kind of told to pin it, keep it away. And it has such a, you know, such a toxic effect on our lives, relationships, our own bodies and stuff like that. So
because I mean, you cannot, people will confuse the kind of anger you have if you feel that things are unfair or not just, right? You're seeking justice in some sense. You're protesting perhaps That's a kind of anger, maybe even like, could be even described as a kind of hatred, but it's not a bad form of hatred if you don't let out of people, I mean, other than speaking up. Mm-hmm. But then if you hate people in some of the other senses, then it's probably bad, right? If you hate people because they're women or because they're black or I cannot see any situation where that would be considered or could be considered a positive thing.
Right. Absolutely. Cool. Well, Britt, thank you so much for your time. This has been an amazing conversation. I was excited justifiably with talking with you today. So this is amazing. So I really do appreciate your time covering this with me a lot.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I really enjoyed the conversation too.
Cool. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiequercone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.